I started as a listener when I was pretty small, listening to jazz and pop music and classical music. And I didn't really, I was already playing an instrument, but the listening that I did didn't have any relationship to being a performer until much later. I started really improvising jazz around the beginning of high school, maybe a little bit before, but really just taking a stab in the dark and just trying to play notes that I thought were good notes. I didn't know anything about it, didn't have an education for it. But what changed was in my junior year in high school, I had a school year abroad in Barcelona, and I met a bunch of people my age that were playing jazz and that were listening to Weather Report and Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers and Miles Davis. And it was the first time I had met people my age that were interested in jazz. I also listened to a lot of progressive rock, like Gentle Giant and things like that. And I still listen to modern classical, and I really gravitated towards the more recent jazz. I think starting with Cecil Taylor and Eric Dolphy and progressives like Booker Little and Thelonious Monk and Wayne Shorter, but in the 70s, electric Miles Davis and electric Ornette Coleman. I didn't gravitate towards that with any sort of social awareness about it what it was, but more like just really emotionally pulled in by the music. And it was only later that I realized, what an important part of American society and what an important thing to learn about my country that I didn't know was knowing that music. And I faced the challenge of the trumpet in that technically I had never been a good trumpet player, and I just had atrocious chops. And my first year at Berkeley, I had a teacher who really just didn't know how to help me, but just had me as a student the whole year. And I was getting a lot out of composition and arranging and all the other courses, but I wasn't progressing as a trumpet player. And in my final lesson of my freshman year, he told me I should quit and do something else. You laugh, but imagine. I mean, it was really scary. I'd been playing for, 10 years by then. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I transferred out of Berkeley and went to New England Conservatory, where I met John McNeil, who is a wonderful trumpet player and composer, but also a really gifted teacher who was able to help me not only with the technical aspect by introducing me to the technique of Carmine Caruso, but also helped me to get clear on some things about playing bebop and playing chord language.
Mm-hmm. Now, I imagine you were also playing a lot in clubs and on stages, and I wonder if you could talk about the education you got from performance at that time.
Well, I was playing a lot. I was playing on the street with bands quite a bit, and so that was really good to build your chops playing in Times Square for 4 hours a day with amplified guitar and bass and a drum set, no microphones. But I was also doing any gig that would come along just to try to survive. So weddings, bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, brisses, divorces, Sir Walter Raleigh gigs. I mean, it was really just the phone would ring and I would say, what time and what do I have to wear? And I did that for a lot of years, and I think that was a really great education. I mean, I look back on that time and I remember how much I did not enjoy those gigs, but I also remember how much I learned from having to do them and having to show up and not have any idea what the music was going to be and like very quickly figure out how to do the right thing.
Right.
And I feel like as an improviser, that's basically still what I do.
Right. Now, you got a pretty good break earlier in your career hooking up with Horace Silver. Can you tell me about that time?
Yeah, that was a complete surprise. I mean, by that time, I was kind of gigging around. I was still playing in the street. I had just graduated. Pretty soon after I was out of school, I played on this record called Second Sight. It was a group led by the piano player John Esposito, and we made an LP, and somehow it got into the hands of Horace Silver, and I got a call on my answering machine from Horace asking me to come and join the band. I had grown up always wanting to be a jazz messenger, and Horace was one of the founders of the Jazz Messengers. It was a dream. I'd never made that much money in my life, and it wasn't, you know, of all the jazz gigs that were happening, it wasn't the best paid one by a long shot, but that didn't matter to me. I mean, I probably would have done it for free.
Yeah.
You know, and taken a cruise ship gig to pay to go play with Horace Silver. Flying to Malibu, staying at Horace's house for a week, rehearsing every day, and Horace was kind of a stickler for how to play, and he would pick apart my playing and point things out that were pretty extraordinary and some lessons that are still with me. And then I toured with him for a period of months, and I learned so much about presentation, about construction of a set, about traveling, about being in the world, about the jazz scene. I met so many people. I mean, there's a clip on YouTube of us playing since 1987, and it's the Bern Jazz Festival, and I finally forced myself to watch it, and it's so amazing to hear what I was doing, and I think I was trying to go someplace, but I was also trying to make Horace happy, and and that gig, if you do go and see it on YouTube, remember that Clark Terry was sitting in the front row right in front of me. And it was just one of those things where I was like, okay, here goes.
Right. I think shortly after that, another important collaboration for you was John Zorn's Masada. Can you tell us a little bit about working with John Zorn?
Yeah, I mean, I would say we just talked about playing with Horace Silver, and there was a period in between there where I was still doing a lot of so-called commercial work. Anything, but also some of the leaders that first started to hire me for creative stuff were, well, I had a long relationship with Vincent Herring, the saxophonist, that was important for me. But then Tim Byrne, I had a short period where I played his music with him. We never recorded anything together, but that was really influential for me. Myra Melford was a great collaboration for me. Being on the road with her and Marty Ehrlich and Lindsay Horner and later Eric Friedlander. And I started to lead my own groups and, you know, hadn't really gotten to make a record yet, but I was just beginning to be a band leader and have all these different projects when I met John Zorn at the Knitting Factory around 92, maybe 93. And John asked me to play on this movie soundtrack called Thieves Quartet. And we got the score done in a couple hours and then spent the rest of the afternoon playing Masada tunes, which I didn't really know what they were. There were these little chicken scratch lead sheets of songs that were his. The fact that this was a quartet that was tightly knit, John, me, Greg Cohen, Joey Barron. It gave it a sense of urgency and fire that is the core of John Zorn's project in everything that he does. And I'd never been around anyone like that. It pushed me to new heights as a player. John Zorn, as you may know, has an enormous vocabulary as an alto saxophone player. Not just extended techniques, but all sorts of musical strategies and devices. And I found myself, having practiced, you know, bebop and hard bop and post bop for so many years, having nothing to play. Like, I would play everything I knew how to play, and then he's still going. And so I just, on the stage, I would have to come up with something. John is still an inspiration. We're still close friends, and we still play from time to time, and there's always new things on the horizon, and I consider him, you know, one of the big alliances in my life that's been really important for me. And it really, it pushed me into this kind of playing that I didn't grow up doing.
Looking at some of your past recordings, and you've got really, really busy making a lot of records. There's so many different settings, and you've mentioned a lot of different players you've played with, and I wonder if that's important to you to keep trying new things.
Well, what's important to me is just to keep working, and to me, working means doing something you haven't done before and pushing yourself into new places. And I think, you know, people throw around the word new all the time. To me, new means something that I have not encountered before. And you find that you encounter something that's new for you and it's really fresh for you. And then you do a little research and you find out that other people have also explored this area. But I don't think that takes away, you know, if somebody's never heard Charlie Parker and they get all inspired and start playing Charlie Parker tunes, that's new for them. That's new music. I'm sorry.
And some of the diversity I've talked about, I'd love to talk to you just about a couple of things there. Your work with dancers, and I wonder how that affected the way you play.
Well, I think writing for dance and film, you have to think differently. You leave a space in the music for the other side of the collaboration, and it allows you to think more in terms of landscape and picture painting and... I think that's an important aspect. It's a very tricky one. But writing for Trisha Brown was a big boost for me. And I think that when I wrote the film scores for the early Buster Keaton and Fatty Arbuckle films, that there was a lesson in there for me. I mean, Miles Davis always said that when he wrote The Escalator to the Gallows, it opened up something new for him that permitted him to do a record like Kind of Blue. And I can see that. I feel that. That when I wrote the score for Spark of Being, the Bill Morrison film, that's a very dense score. And his film is very dense and very saturated. But still, there was a negotiation of what has a place and what doesn't, and it takes in extra musical ideas.
You've also done some really interesting projects having to do with geography. There was a piece meant to be played at 10,000 feet high altitude, and you did another performance, I believe, where you hiked to a location with the audience and performed at a location. And just recently for your 50th birthday, the idea of traveling to all 50 states. And I wonder if geographic context changes music at all.
Of course it does. Well, it's an odd question. I wrote a suite called Mountain Passages at the invitation of a festival called Sounds of the Dolomites in Trentino, northern Italy. All the concerts take place at altitude in the Italian Dolomites. And you have to hike to the concert, and so does the audience. But the concert is at sunrise, so the downbeat is at 6 a.m. And it's an arrangement of the Mountain Passages suite, and which was the first recording for Greenleaf Music. But also when we toured it, we played in New York at the Village Vanguard for a week, which is actually in a basement, so it was underground. And so it was like short of going to the Dead Sea to play this piece. You know, it was about as far away as you could get geographically, and it felt different. It's not just the thinness of the air. It's also, I think it's more about the people that are there. I think audiences have a bigger impact on jazz and improvised music than they think they do. That you're really influencing, and not to be mamby-pamby about it, but there's a vibration in the air, and we feel it. On stage, you know, when we're improvising, you know, we're really open to everything that's going on in the room, and we're reacting to it. And an audience that is there with us, breathing, is taking us to a higher place as we take them to a higher place.
You've mentioned Greenleaf Music. That's your record label, greenleafmusic.com. You have a very prolific recording schedule. You record a lot of your live performances. And I wonder, you have a wonderful way of doing not only downloaded music for sale, but also releasing vinyl records. And I wonder if you have any good music business, record business insights for how a record label should be run.
Well, you know, I do my best to treat all the artists fairly and to really support them. this is supposed to be a platform to help the music grow and move forward. And that's the reason that I have the company. I do a lot of, I do mostly studio albums for Greenleaf, and all the records that I've done under my own name for the past 10 years have been on Greenleaf. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a catalog now, and I keep them in print, and so I'm proud that people can come to this website and check it out. There's a lot of ways that you can come and be a part of it. You know, of course, we hope that people will come and buy something or even subscribe to the label. It really helps us out. But I also feel like, you know, just the milestone of the music being there, there's always things that you can listen to and videos and lots of good information. I started a podcast series last year where I interview musicians about their music, and I play excerpts of their music and just talk to them about how they think about it. And it's inspiring for me because everybody thinks so differently. Mm-hmm. We've had people from Henry Threadgill to Matt Mitchell to Mary Halverson to Desron Douglas to, oh geez, there's about 30 episodes now. So I'm happy to do that. And I also try to put up sheet music of all the albums that we put out. And I think that's, you know, it's not for everybody, but I like the fact that it's available. And that I like to be available for people who want to correspond about what we're doing. I think I feel closer to the people who listen to my music than I ever did when I was at a major label. And that feels really good.